The Great Bible Reset is a podcast devoted to counteracting the great economic reset of Klaus Schwab using Bible lessons and theory. Thank you to boomers-alive.com for sponsoring this podcast and the Kingsway Classical Academy. This week, we are continuing our study on the great books of Western civilization and their effect on our current economical and spiritual crisis. And now your host, Oliver Woods.
Well, welcome, everybody. You are at greatbiblereset.com, where we explore the question, what is God's great controversy with America today and indeed the world? And, you know, when things weren't going well in Puritan New England, the first question they would ask, you know, is what is God's great controversy with New England? And things are certainly not going well in America today. So let's talk about, you know, Klaus Schwab's great economic reset that threatens us into tyranny versus God's great Bible reset into liberty under law, and that being the only alternative, the only remedy for what we're facing. And where are we with that? And I haven't been in every church in America, but why is it we never seem to hear anything about the need for a national covenant renewal with God, such as they had in the 1600s. So we've got with us today one big exception to that general rule, Pastor Ted Weiland, who wrote a book about a decade ago called "Bible Law versus the United States Constitution," in which he did a paragraph-by-paragraph comparison of the U.S. Constitution with the Bible. And to our knowledge, he's the first one that's ever actually done that. We're so used to assuming that the Constitution is biblical that we rarely take the time to actually compare it with the Scripture. So today he's going to get into that a little bit with us and how he's seeing this gradual manifestation in Nebraska and even beyond through his books and so forth. So maybe Pastor Weiland, you could tell us a little bit about what's going on there in Nebraska and your website and so forth.
You bet. Thank you, first of all, for having me on your program. I appreciate it very much, and particularly because of the material we're covering, which I'm convinced is absolutely crucial for us ever to get where most Christians and patriots today want to see us taken, and are instead using, ironically, sadly, tragically, using the genesis of the reason America finds herself on the precipice of moral depravity and destruction as the alleged solution to the problems it's caused. And we're dealing with the Constitution, and it's not a popular document. I'm not necessarily a very popular man, because you start dealing with the nation's idols and idols don't die easily. And this is one, boy, it does not die easily. But we've made incredible headway in opening hearts and minds. I've got a 10-question survey concerning the Constitution as it relates to the Bible. On our website, which is Bible Versus spelled out, V-E-R-S-U-S, BibleVersusConstitution.org. It's in the right-hand column. If you take that, you'll receive a free copy of the 85-page primer of the book, Bible Law Versus United States Constitution, The Christian Perspective, that you just mentioned. Because I make that book free, and all of my other books they're available on our online book page, available as free, including the 575-page Bible Law versus Constitution book in its entirety. All of my books are there, or almost all of them are on our online book page. You can also get the primer by taking the survey. And I do that because this is such a crucial cutting-edge issue for us to ever get back to what America was in the early 1600s, where we find our true biblical history of America when they had governments of, by, and for God rather than a secular humanist government of, by, and for the people as created by the constitutional framers. And so I, back to my statement that I really appreciate being on your program because it's this subject that we're addressing. This is one of the two major idols in America, and particularly in the hearts of Christians and patriots, that has to come down if we're ever going to do this thing, if our posterity is ever going to have a chance to do it right, and let's make right righteous the next time around. And so I really appreciate. So if you want to know about Ted Weiland, probably the best place to go is BibleVersusConstitution.org. Be sure to take the survey so we can send you the free primer. And check out the online book page particularly as well, where you can find all of our books there available free of charge as well. Or I, if you can't afford a donation, I will send you, but you want one of the books itself for yourself, as long as you'll use it for yourself or for someone else, I'll send you the books free. Because this is such a critical issue that has to be dealt with. If we're ever going to get to where we want to go, this issue has to be dealt with. It's the idol that stands in our way right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for that. Yeah. So we're going to focus on Article 6 today. And I think, if I recall, there's three paragraphs or clauses there. And you make some interesting comments, observations about the first one, which has to do with debt. But maybe that's a topic for another time. Paragraph 2 and paragraph 3 in particular reinforce this the problem that we find in the Constitution. One of the things that we hear sometimes is that Madison, you know, is known as the father of the Constitution, and he and other of the founding fathers were looking at religious wars that were going on at this time or just prior to this time in Europe and saying, well, you know, this is what religion leads to, it just conflict and war and so forth. And in fact, in Federalist Number 10, Madison said religion was the source of all faction, you know. So what are your thoughts on that, Pastor Weiland? You know, was there any justification, you know, for leaving God and Christianity out of the Constitution because of that, for that reason?
Well, depends on what kind of document you want to create. If you want to create a biblical document, how can you leave God, our creator and sovereign over his entire creation, and therefore his moral law is the supreme law of the land? And that is the biggest issue with Article 6. In fact, let me read you, I think it's the part of the first, it may be the second clause of Article 6, but let me read this to your audience so they know what we're talking about here in particular. It says, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof," so all the laws made in pursuance thereof afterwards, "and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, the supreme law of the land, the Constitution, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything to the Constitution or laws, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding." So the real issue with Article 6 is the supreme law of the land, that's the Constitution. And as I mentioned in our last interview, let's not forget, the Constitution is a godless, Christless, and biblically lawless document. Biblically lawless, in this instance, it's biblically lawless throughout. Nearly every article and every amendment is either antithetical or seditious to Yahweh's sovereignty and morality. But by biblically lawless in this statement, I mean that there is no mention of God's law and or even his word in this Constitution. It is a completely humanistic, secular document that is also contrary throughout God's law. And so That's what they made the supreme law of the land, and everything, the countless, there's millions of other laws that have been added to the supreme law that are on the books, so many so that they can't even number them. I often point out that if Moses were to come down Mount Sinai with today's constitutional laws, he wouldn't have come down the mountain with two tablets. He'd have came down the mountain with a hernia, a busted back, and an untold number of wagons pulled by both donkeys and elephants, pun intended.
Right.
So that, keep in mind, we're not, when we're talking about the supreme law, we're not talking about just the Constitution and its amendments, but everything made in pursuance thereof and all the treaties that were made. And it is such a, it's supposed to have created a limited government. Talk about burdensome. You can't do anything today now because of the laws on the books that's not a crime. Everybody, according to the Constitution and the laws made thereof, are criminals. But so Article 6, well, let me say it this way. Idolatry is not so much about statues as it is statutes, S-T-A-T-U-T-E-S, statutes. It's not so much about statues as it is statutes, such as what one considers the supreme law of the land. Well, listen, there can only be one supreme law, either the Constitution per Article 6 or God's law per the Bible, God's moral law, that is his Ten Commandments, statutes, and judgments. And to futilely attempt to meld those two, as Christians do over, they don't attempt to do it. They just say that it is. Most of them haven't even read the Constitution to know that it doesn't work. But to futilely attempt to meld the Constitution and the Bible is to be as double-minded as were the Israelites with Elijah on Mount Carmel when he said, "Why halt you between two opinions?" And I'm going to change it just a little bit now. And I'm going to say, if we the people, which by the way is a contemporary form of Baalism. I've got a blog article on the website called "Could You Be a Disciple of Baal and Not Know It?" And I would encourage people to go look at that blog article. But back to Elijah's statement: why halt you between two opinions? If we the people, a contemporary form of Baal, be God, serve them. But if Yahweh be God, serve him. And so you can't meld the two. It's utterly impossible to take what is biblical and what is biblically seditious, the Constitution, as proven in nearly every article and amendment when examined by the Bible, the only ethical standard by which everything should be examined. And you can't meld the two. They are completely impossible to meld. And yet many Christians and patriots today have been hoodwinked into believing they can be, and that even more so that this supreme law that they created, there can only be one supreme law. And if it's God's law, if you can agree that, well, the supreme law is God's law, then why did they have to create a document in the first place other than what God had already created and provided for us in his Ten Commandments, statutes, and judgments, which were the law? You think, well, nobody's had that as a law of government. Oh, yes, they did. Right here in America in the early 1600s, the governments, not governments of, by, and for the people, but governments of, by, and for God, it were expressly established upon God's law, the Ten Commandments, their statutes that explain them, and the civil judgments that enforce them. And that is the reason, Oliver, that is the reason why America became great, or also known as blessed by God. It's the result. We didn't become a great nation because of what happened in the late 1700s and the supreme law they created back with the Constitution. America became great based on Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14, and the blessings found therein, because they looked to God as sovereign and his laws as supreme. Whereas ever since 1787 in particular, when the framers created the Constitution, ever since, America has incrementally at first, God's awfully long-suffering, but we have been under the curses of Deuteronomy 28, 15 through 68, because they rejected Yahweh as America's sovereign, turned it over to we the people, and his law as sovereign, and replaced it with a biblically egregious constitution that is has become an idol to far too many people, and that has to be dealt with for what it is. And that's, of course, one of the many reasons why I wrote Bible Law versus the United States Constitution.
Hmm. Yeah, that's such a good point. You know, we're just buried in law. A legalistic society and litigious society, and where God's law is just one law. You know, he says there'll be one law for the homegrown and one law for the stranger, and one law for every application. And it was so simple that even the children, you know, when they would read it periodically in the Old Testament, even the children, you know, were required to be there and could pretty much understand it, you know, and learn from that reading. And now we're just who knows what? Nobody knows the extent of our legal system. It's so complex. There's a best-selling book out right now. I wonder if you could maybe comment a little bit on. It's called In Defense of Christian Nationalism, and it's put out by Canon Press, and purports to lay a foundation of political theory as the foundation on which to erect and the edifice of political theology. And the author in the introduction, in fact, admits he has no skill and training in biblical exegesis or interpretation. What are your thoughts on that? It seems to me it's the kind of thing we've seen a lot of throughout the history of the West that has, you know, led to our problem, where we tend to elevate, he calls them natural principles, or basically natural law, above. I mean, we try to use that to either prove the Bible or somehow bolster the Bible, and it ends up backfiring. Do you have any thoughts on that, Pastor Wyman?
Well, when it comes to a national covenant, of course, that's wasn't that part of the title of the book?
I think it's In Defense of Christian Nationalism.
Christian Nationalism, okay. Here's the problem, as I've seen with that kind of material. I have not read that book, but with that kind of material, that's usually coming out of today's contemporary Christian and patriot circles, and somewhere therein, and if you know the book, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but somewhere therein, those people with good intentions send us back to the very document that's the genesis of all of America's woes today as the solution for the problems it created. And if you're going to have a Christian, or I prefer even using a biblical covenant, you've got to do it biblical. And you can't take us back to a secular humanist document such as the United States Constitution and think that we're going to end up with a Christian nation again, or even on a local basis. We've got to do it biblical, which means we've got to return to our, if we're going to return to anything, we want to return to our biblical roots, which are found not in the late 1700s by any stretch of the imagination, but in the early 1600s, such as I mentioned in the previous interview, such as in New Haven, Connecticut, and their constitution. And if you Google and read even to just the first paragraph or so, you can see the contrast between what was biblical then and created governments of, by, and for God rather than a humanistic government of, by, and for the people, expressly established on God's laws, and biblically qualified men of God who governed exclusively by God's law, not by these created laws that can change at the whim of whoever's the next administration and the people under him. And so if we're going to, if they're going to do it, if they're going to do what their titles of their books and such would indicate, it's got to be done biblically. And you can't send us back to the very document that's created the problems we're trying to overcome in order to accomplish that end. You just keep cycling through the same problems over and over and over again, because it's only going to recreate what created this mess in the first place. So I'm all for the idea of Christian or biblical nationalism. And I believe that's going to be on a very limited local basis that that's got to be created. Particularly small local basis. And it may not be done everywhere, but if we can even get it started in just a few places, then we'll start experiencing God's blessings again, at least in those areas, rather than his curses. And I think once that begins to happen, Oliver, people are going to see it. They're going to say, wow. It's what Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 5 through 8 talks about, where he says, you know, Moses says, you know, you need to be applying, I'm paraphrasing, you need to be applying these laws because the other nations, okay, so he's dealing with Israel, of course, and he says the other nations are going to see it. And they're going to say, what great nation is this that has such great laws? And because they're seeing the blessings of it is the import there, the intent there. And so it's by doing it righteous that we're going to be able to, you know, even on starting at one location, getting it done, and then it multiplies. And as a nation, when it finally is accomplished nationally, if indeed that's God's will for our nation again, then the other nations around the world will say, wow. And that's what they did. And that's what they did before as a result of what happened in the 1600s, not the late 1700s. They said, wow, what a great nation. We want to be like them. And they, which pointed them to our God and his perfect laws. But ever since the late 1787, America has now been under the curse, and we're really seeing it come home. Because America is now precipitously teetering on the precipice of that moral depravity and destruction where we find ourselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and here's something interesting is that the whole we the people idea was to turn over, quote unquote, turn over, for example, the vote to the discretion of we the people, the majority of whom are in the Broadway leading to destruction for Christ in Matthew 5, 13 and 14. Well, no wonder we're on the edge of destruction. You take the authority from Yahweh and turn it over to we the people, the majority who are ever in the Broadway leading to destruction, where are you going to end up? You're going to end up right where we find ourselves today, on the precipice of moral depravity and destruction.
Yeah. And you're right. The book does call us back to the Constitution,
to the very problem that created the whole mess. And that it's so ironic. But and that's why we've got to spend time. Why I thank you for putting this together so that we can awaken more people to say, hey, you guys, I know you mean well, but you're creating just you're making the problem worse, not better.
Yeah. In our reasoning. And, you know, a good summary is in the middle of the book of Exodus, where we, Exodus 20 through 24, we've got the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, and then there's three chapters of case law, God calls them ordinances, in chapter 24. And then 24 is the covenant itself, the Mosaic covenant, where the people said, all that the Lord has commanded, we will do. And, I mean, it's a good place to start, because it's the first thing, I think, it's a good it's the first thing that God gave to Moses, you know, the first revelation that he brought down. And other laws were added throughout the Pentateuch and really the whole Bible. But to get a really good handle, that's a good place to start. And we've actually got a commentary on that at on the bookstore at KingswayClassicalAcademy.com. KingswayClassicalAcademy.com. But let's talk a little bit about this paragraph 3, clause 3, whatever it is. The religious test oath,
we're jumping into the First Amendment. Do we want to go there, or do we want to stay with
The one that says
you're right. That's Article 6.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's if you go back a year prior to the Constitutional Convention, Jefferson and Madison had collaborated on a document called the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, and where they, among other things, one of the statements in there is that a man's opinions about religion have no more influence on his qualification for public office than his opinions about geometry or any other science. And this is actually on Jefferson's tombstone, along with the Declaration of Independence. The two things he felt were the great accomplishments of his life. But any thoughts on that? You know, and how that worked itself into the Constitution, especially in Article 3 there, or Clause 3 of Article 6.
Well, you know, I would ask the question of your audience, and that is, have you ever wondered how America ended up with the caliber of leaders that she has today? And, you know, could it possibly be because of Article 6, what religious test ban, where they removed, and more importantly, not so much the religious test ban, which is referring back to the religious test of several of the states, all but one, I believe, where they had religious tests. Very weak test, by the way. But the real issue of Article 6 Christian test ban is that it also thereby eliminated mandatory biblical qualifications, according to God in the Bible, that is, mandatory biblical qualifications for civil leaders. So if you've ever, how did we end up with the Clintons and the Obamas and the Pelosis and in fact, everyone on the other side of the imaginary aisle as well, both donkeys and elephants alike. How did we end up with these jokers? And that's putting it so lightly. What we've ended up with is incompetence, immoral reprobates, outright criminals, and we could add a whole lot of other things in there as well. How did we end up with these guys? Well, could it possibly be because of Article 6 removal of the Christian test ban and thereby the mandatory biblical qualifications for civil leaders that God intends? Mm-hmm. Well, of course it could. You can't, you go back to the biblical qualifications of God's law for his civil representatives of his kingdom or his government and his law, and you don't end up with these criminals. You can't end up with any of these, not lest they go astray, but then they would be removed immediately if they did. You end up with, rather than, you know, the best you can get from Article 6 and its removal of mandatory biblical qualifications as the test for civil leaders today, the very best you can get is the lesser of two evils. Sometimes, though, it's the worst of the worst. I think we're seeing that today. And always the evil of two lessers. Whereas under God's system, where it's his government, a government of, by, and for God under his sovereignty, and thereby established upon his triune moral law, the Ten Commandments, the statutes that explain them, which you called case laws, and the judgments, the civil judgments that enforce them, who are enforcing only those laws, you end up with biblically qualified men. You end up with the best of the best every single time. We don't get the best of the best. America's never got the best of the best because the constitutional framers in Article 6 eliminated the means to have the best of the best by making no religious tests. No religious test, you get to be, and they provided really no qualifications whatsoever. And therefore, anybody can run for government if they convince enough people, if they're popular enough, because that's what they are, they're popular elections. And if they're popular enough or got enough charisma, all of a sudden, anybody, anybody with any morality or serving any God, and that's why we have Muslims and Hindus and everything else under the sun representing other gods and their cultures and their laws, serving as civil leaders today. So you end up with what we have today as civil leaders. And so therefore, if you are a proponent of the Constitution and thereby Article 6 making it the supreme law of the land and everything else found in that article and throughout the rest of the Constitution as amendments, you are responsible for the civil leaders we have today, whether your man won the election or not, because you're promoting a system that provides for two parties and gives it's an endless merry-go-round that goes round and round, giving everybody their opportunity to serve as civil leaders with no qualifications for whatsoever, whether they be Republicans or Democrats or what I call elephants or donkeys.
Well, yeah, that's certainly true. In terms of the selection of leaders, you know, I think it's Deuteronomy 1 and around verse 13 talks about, I think it talks about like nominating leaders. But then we have the example of the choice of the 12th disciple to replace Judas and the casting of lots. Any thoughts on that? You know, would something like that apply to civil government?
Absolutely. And that, in fact, that is God's plan. That's his election system, the biblical election system versus it's intrinsic in the Constitution's election system for fraud to exist, because the constitutional framers took election authority, usurped Yahweh, the God of the Bible's exclusive election authority. Deuteronomy 17:15. He is the one. You're to have civil leaders. There it talks about kings under that time that he chose. He elects. God never had an idea that man would elect anybody, let alone without biblical qualifications. And so the constitutional framers usurped God's exclusive authority and turned it over to the quote-unquote discretion of we the people, and as I mentioned, the majority of whom are in the broad way leading to destruction. Whereas God's system, his intent was that God makes the choice of the leader. Man's position in that is that they nominate between biblically qualified candidates for whom God would then choose. And how does he choose? Well, he gave us a perfect example in Acts chapter 1 when Judas was being replaced with another apostle. And what did they do? And they said that we may know your choice, Lord, what it is. Guide us in knowing your choice. And what did they do? They threw lots. And Matthias, God selected, not man, or elected Matthias to be the replacement for Judas. And if you go to Proverbs 16:33, it says that the lot is thrown into the lap and every decision thereof is of God. And then Proverbs 18:18, it says it's the means of choosing between, I forget exactly what it says, but between biblically qualified men of God. You leave it to God to say, God, the only one who knows the hearts of the man. That contrasted with what goes on today with no biblical qualifications. It's nothing but a popularity contest by which anybody can be elected. And the best you can get out of it is the lesser of two evils, sometimes the worst of the worst, and always the evil of two lessers. Because you've eliminated everything that makes them the best of the best of biblically qualified men of God. And no wonder we have what we have today. you know, over America as civil, quote unquote, leaders. So yeah, there's some real problems, and I address in Bible Law versus the United States Constitution. It'll be chapter 9. Is the chapter 9 I deal with Article 6, and in that, not only as it concerns it as the supreme law of the land, which is as biblically seditious as you can get when only God is sovereign and only his law is supreme, but I also have a large section on the Constitutional Republic's election system. I would also suggest two blog articles that I have up on our website, and if you go to our blog and then search for, it's called Constitutional Elections Dining at the Devil's Table, and then if they also go to it has to do with elections and salvation. I forget the exact title now, but in that I explain the biblical election process that we just talked about, where men, as men, we nominate biblically qualified men, just like they did in Acts chapter 1, and then God makes the election through the casting of lots. And that seems that's going to seem real odd to people, but if we trust God in his word, particularly as it's found in Proverbs 16:33 and 18:18, and there's examples also of that occurring in the election of civil leaders in the Old Testament and then also in Acts 1, we're going to say, hey, God knows best, and we got to take this out of our hands because we don't know the hearts of men, and we certainly don't want to be electing biblically unqualified men into unbiblical positions of civil leadership who, if elected, they will swear allegiance to the biblically seditious Constitution as the law of the land, which only perpetuates the problems we have. It'll only escalate our suicidal trip to the precipice.
Well, and not to mention all of the time and energy and expense that we expend every, it's almost a nonstop campaigning anymore.
Imagine this. Imagine if we took the millions, and really it's billions. I would like to see a total if somebody could ever come up with it. But it's got to be in the billions, maybe even trillions of dollars that have been spent on presidential campaigns. Think what that would do if that money was removed from them and it was applied to getting us back to God's kingdom, his government here on earth as it is in heaven, and doing things biblically. What that money could have been done over the last 235 years for America if it had been applied for government of, by, and for God, established expressly upon his law and governed exclusively by biblically qualified men. You talk about a waste of money, just like you said.
Yeah, wow.
Squandered.
Yep. Well, thanks, Pastor Weiland. This is looks like this is going to become a three-part series. We're looking forward to having you back again next week to discuss Amendment 1, First Amendment, right?
You bet. I look forward to it.
Yeah, great. Well, then, so thanks for being here, and thanks, everybody, for listening in, and look forward to picking this up again a week from now, and we'll be starting with another classical author, analyzing them biblically on Tuesday as well. So we'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. For more episodes, visit greatbiblereset.com. And to help support the podcast and Kingsway Classical Academy, visit our sponsor at boomers-alive.com. To learn how to get your high school diploma and bachelor's degree on the same day, visit KingswayClassicalAcademy.com and save up to $100,000 on college tuition.